50-53 conflict was only suspended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. And because of the tension with North Korea, South Korea requires all able-bodied men to serve a year and a half in the armed forces. More and more South Koreans are not buying into the rhetoric of militaristic antagonism. Activist Shin Jae-uk this week launched an online museum, a group effort exposing disturbing aspects of the Korean War with previously restricted material.
The War Memorial Hall was established in the name of patriotism education to extol anti-communist ideology. It is centered on generals and heroes, not ordinary soldiers or civilians, and is belligerent about war and glorifies it.
Documents in the exhibit confirm the U.S. military's use of napalm in the Korean War and suspicions that a South Korean general destroyed a bridge across the Han River, preventing thousands of civilians from retreating.
This exhibit is about the stories of people who are hidden behind the ideology that national security is most important. It comes from the perspective of war victims. We want to let people know that war is not allowed, and there is no just war in the world. And when war breaks out, people are forced to die this way.
Some 2.3 million people were killed during the Korean War, often called the Forgotten War or the Never-Ending War. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight. Two more Catholic churches on First Nation reserves in Western Canada have been destroyed by fires that investigators are once again treating as suspicious. Over the weekend, crews in southern British Columbia responded to early morning blazes at St. Anne's Church on Upper Similkameen Indian Band land and the Tropaka Church on the lands of the Lower Similkameen Indian Band. Both churches, built from wood and more than 100 years old, were burnt to the ground. Investigators are treating the fires as suspicious. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Leyland Sacco. The piece is titled, Canada, Two More Catholic Churches on First Nation Reserves Destroyed by Fire. Two more Catholic churches on First Nation reserves in Western Canada have been destroyed by fires that investigators are once again treating as suspicious. Over the weekend, crews in southern British Columbia responded to early morning blazes at St. Anne's Church on Upper Similkameen Indian Band land and the Chopaka Church on the lands of the Lower Similkameen Indian Band. Both churches, built from wood and more than 100 years old, were burnt to the ground. Investigators are treating both fires as suspicious. The fires come nearly a week after two other churches were destroyed and amid growing anger over the church's role in Canada's campaign of forcibly assimilating Indigenous people. In recent weeks, the country has been rocked by the discovery of nearly 1,000 unmarked graves at the sites of church-run residential schools where Indigenous children were forcibly converted to Christianity and stripped of their original names, customs, and language. The Catholic Church has faced calls for greater transparency over its role in the residential schools and an apology from the Pope. After the fires this weekend, the chief and council of the Lower Similkameen Indian Band said in a statement they were in disbelief and angered. It will be felt deeply for those that sought comfort and solace in the church. But the statement also acknowledged the grief and rage many Indigenous communities were feeling across the country after the discovery of unmarked graves by the Minister Kamloops to Secwepemc First Nation in British Columbia and the Cowessess First Nation in Saskatchewan. This is a symptom of the intergenerational trauma our survivors and intergenerational descendants are experiencing. There are supports to help deal with these emotions in a more healing way, the Lower Similkameen said. Friday, 25th of June, the Catholic Missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate, which operates 48 schools, including the two former schools where the unmarked mass graves were found, said it would release all documents in its possession. Chief Keith Crow of the Lower Similkameen said in an interview with Castanet that the fires have been devastating for Catholics in the community, who recently had a service in the church 2 weeks ago, but warned communities were in for more hurt now as searches for unmarked graves have started in other communities. Chief Keith Crow added, when all the rest of the residential schools start doing testing, there's just going to be more and more pain that comes out. The 215 graves found at the first site was just the start.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Does a woman who lives in an extended family, all right, have any kind of responsibilities or duties toward her in-laws? Some people are under this kind of impression that they need to serve everyone as long as they are married, like to, for example, a whole clan or family or something like that.
Well, expectations are too high when a bride goes into another family. Everyone expects her to, let's say, render services, to do some chores, and to be available for everyone. That's not the case, you know. And of course, Muslim families need to somehow change their attitude and belief.
Mentality.
Yeah, and mentality towards the bride and the bride's responsibility. A bride's responsibility is only exclusive and specific to the husband.
Yes.
She has to be available for her husband only. She has to submit herself to her husband, and she has to fulfill her conjugal rights and matrimonial obligations, which are preserved for the husband.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the wife has no responsibility whatsoever towards her in-laws, towards her father-in-law, her
mm-hmm.
mother-in-law, and her husband's siblings, you know. And she is not supposed to do washing up, cooking, cleaning the house. And of course, she has the right to ask her husband to provide her with a separate accommodation.
Yes.
So that she should have her privacy.
I see.
And she should have the calm and comfort that she needs, you know. In an extended family, of course, the wife has to observe hijab because there are cousins, uncles, nephews, and everyone else are there.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going in, coming out. So it becomes a kind of unbearable situation for the woman to keep wearing dresses even in the hot season, and to provide them with food and drink and to cook for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's not her responsibility. And of course, everyone has to do her own task of cooking food, and there should be an arrangement for that, you know, and an understanding. Yes, of course, if the wife wants to do this on her own accord, on her own, willingness,
mm-hmm.
and she is willing to do this.
Yes,
to sacrifice herself for the whole family. There is no objection. Morally speaking, it's good for the wife to wash the clothes and to wash her husband's clothes and to cook for her husband, because her husband.
And if she does that, it's out of her favor, right?
Yeah, she's doing favor to her husband and to her husband's family,
mm-hmm.
you know. Otherwise, they cannot punish the wife for not doing this, you see. So, generally speaking, the wife has no responsibility, no duty to fulfill towards the in-laws. And, of course, there are some mutual and reciprocal
obligations
as long as one of them, one party to the marriage, fulfills his or her obligation, the other party is also supposed to fulfill and carry out his or her obligation. Yes. For example, the husband has to provide his wife with food, clothing, and medical expenses. This is his. And of course, the wife at the same time is supposed not to leave her husband's house without prior permission from her husband, because this is a right which her husband has on his wife. You know, she cannot leave her husband's house without permission of her husband. This is number one, okay? And she must be available for her husband, you know, must be available for her husband in terms of, you know, sexual pleasure, conjugal rights, and physical intimacy. You know, this is the right of the husband. And of course, the wife also has similar rights. For example, mm-hmm. If it is feared that the wife might fall into a sin because of the husband not having physical relationship with his wife, then it is obligatory for the husband to have physical intimacy, to have sexual intercourse with his wife, so as to make sure that his wife does not fall into a sin.
Right.
You see? And he has to fulfill his wife's physical needs as well.
I see.
Yeah. And of course, if he cannot do it, then he has to either divorce his wife or take some other actions. For example, if a woman needs the physical relationship and she is in dire need of sexual intercourse, then if the husband is unable to have that sexual intercourse, then of course he can use his hand to stimulate her, mm-hmm. to satisfy her, and to make sure that she is satisfied.
I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
The other question is about, some kind of imposed contract of nikah.
Yes.
You know, sometimes there are some high expectations, as you talked about in the last answer to the question. The father or the mother sometimes force their children to get married.
You're right.
All right? For example, in this case, if a father forces his daughter to sign this kind of contract of marriage against her will, all right, is the whole marriage or is the nikah valid, first of all? Or can she disobey her parents or her father? And if she does so, if she disobeys her father, then is she considered a sinner in the eyes of Islamic jurisprudence?
Well, this is a very important question which we need to discuss in detail. First of all, I would like to say that forced marriage is invalid in the first place, mm-hmm. You know.
So it's completely invalid.
And unfortunately, there are a lot of such incidents taking place in different parts of the Muslim countries, you know.
In less developed countries, especially.
Of course, underdeveloped countries, because they are still, they live with their own custom and the mindset has not changed. Even mm-hmm. though Islam continuously and consistently says that there should be no coercion in in marriage. But despite that, the parents try to impose their wish and their desire and their will on the poor girl, forcing her to marry someone she doesn't like, you know. So forced marriage is not allowed, and it is quite within the right of the girl to choose whom to marry and whom not to marry, you know. And the father or the mother of the family can just share their thoughts and give their sincere advice, okay?
Yes.
Because it's very important to advise the daughter to give your advice to the daughter, to tell her about, let's say, about the family of who approaches the for marriage, and it's and as long as the parents give their advice, there's no problem. Then it is up to the girl to choose to marry a particular boy or not to marry, you know. And so the girl, when she herself chooses to marry someone, the marriage is in order, it's okay. But if it is going to be forced, even though she might say yes, okay, but there is compulsion, and out of fear, she says, or she signs a contract. That contract is null and void, is invalid, because there is no willingness on the part of the daughter.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
The United States says it carried out deadly airstrikes on the positions of Iraq Popular Mobilization units on both sides of the border with Syria on Sunday. Washington claimed their strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The attack drew angry reactions from Iraq and Syria. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Syria, for its part, also condemned in strongest terms the U.S. flagrant oppression in the Syrian-Iraqi border region, describing it as a blatant violation of the sanctity of the Syrian and Iraqi territories.
We have to understand instability is the goal. This is when a war cannot necessarily be won, the invader, the attacker, the aggressor can sort of make the next best thing in their interest, and that is for the war to be constant, the war to be permanent, never ending, the chaos to rule supreme, the strategy of chaos, which is that you destabilize a region to such an extent that they will have no choice but to accept your continued presence. This is something that we've seen in Afghanistan as well. How many times has NATO decided and said and promised that they were going to pull back? Now it looks like the Americans are finally going to pull back, but we are. It is really a wait-and-see sort of thing.
Syria says the latest U.S. attack once again showed the recklessness of Washington's policies and the need for Washington to withdraw its aggressive forces from the region. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. But the U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order.
Again, fortunately, this sort of psychological operation hasn't exactly succeeded, because despite everything, the Iraqis definitely, and the Syrians as well, they still don't want U.S. boots on the ground. They want all Americans out. Doesn't matter what the alternative is. They don't want these imperialist invaders to keep occupying their land. But this is what the Americans keep on trying, and this is exactly why they make up these stupid excuses with which to attack and destroy not the terrorists, but the people who fight against the terrorists, because they try to make it almost in an Orwellian way. They try to switch around the definitions and blame the people who are defending their country for terrorism, while they start to portray the terrorists as quote-unquote freedom fighters, or, you know, people who are moderate rebels fight for democracy like they did in Syria.
The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. Apart from the United States, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the U.N. Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba named Pastorkovac vaccine. Iran has also launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine, dubbed Nura, as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering. And I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received his first dose of the Coviron Barakat vaccine on Friday. Coviron Barakat vaccine was approved for emergency mass application by the country's health ministry earlier this month. Before receiving his first dose of the Coviron Barakat vaccine, the leader had set two prior conditions. First, insisting not to receive the vaccine outside the schedule that had been devised for the rest of the Iranians, and second, required to receive only Iranian vaccines. After receiving the jab, the leader thanked all those who were involved in the development of the homegrown vaccine. He said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he noted that he did not want to use a non-Iranian vaccine. That marked the leader's trust in Iranian scientists and his support for domestic production.
I think the first thing it says is that Ayatollah Khamenei himself is demonstrating his approval of this vaccine, and he's showing that he's leading by example in order to instill confidence, one would assume, within the populace as a whole. On the other hand, he's also making it very clear that this vaccine is one that he's accepted because it's produced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, independent of all others.
Coviron Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and it started to be mass-produced on March 29. That placed Iran among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. Under the hardest sanctions, Iran managed to produce its homegrown vaccine. Once again, Iranian scientists proved that nothing is impossible for the Iranian nation, as their will is strong enough to overcome any hardships, including sanctions.
Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The U.S. has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the U.S. aid operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad has said the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention, as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria. He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of U.S. imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fiolin. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
A digital art museum in the Japanese capital has unveiled a stunning exhibition offering visitors an intimate interaction with nature. One of the attractions of the show is Floating Flower Garden, which is a mirrored room filled with 13,000 orchid flowers. The orchids are dangling from the ceiling and move up once a visitor walks through in the space and approaches the flowers. Once the visitors move past, the flowers descend again. This makes the visitors able to freely wander around the three-dimensional flower mass space. Tokyo-based digital art group Team Lab that runs this exhibition says the artwork is designed to help people think that they are part of the garden.
This is an installation filled with these flowers. As you walk towards them, the flowers slowly move up to create an area of space for you. Surrounded so completely by flowers, you feel immersed in the flowers, the garden itself.
There are several other installations in this exhibition. One is an outdoor piece filled with Ovid sculptures that light up after the sun sets. Visitors can see 61 different colors of light in this section. When one of the Ovids tipped over by a hand or the wind, it emits a sound. The sound is then echoed by the surrounding Ovids. In a school in the Ukrainian capital, kids learn about saving the environment and helping those in need through a creative way. Students put plastic bottles in a machine as currency. Then they can select what they would like to spend money on. Buying food for stray animals and donating to children with special needs are some of the choices. The project was first launched in a mall in Kiev a few months ago. Afterwards, the designers found out that children were the most frequent users of this machine.
A child drops a bottle inside and sees an immediate result. It brings joy and happiness, and everyone is excited and wants the project to thrive.
If founders seek to install more and more machines in schools across Ukraine to raise environmental awareness among younger generations. Since the start of the project in October last year, over 5 tons of plastic has been collected from 6 machines.
India is known not only for its cultural diversity, but also for a vibrant assortment of uncountable dishes. Butter chicken is the only one delight you wouldn't like to miss while visiting Indian restaurants, especially if it is prepared by a celebrity chef like Saransh Goyla. Goyla's coal-fired oven is now sending a mouth-watering scent through India's commercial hub, Mumbai, as the young chef takes a break from COVID-19 relief efforts and resumes work. He is the one who established the first global butter chicken brand and authored the acclaimed food travelogue, India on My Platter. But with the coronavirus forcing people into isolation, his networks were also hit. So Goyla launched a non-profit platform called COVID Meals for India in April to connect thousands of volunteer home cooks and frontline workers.
The pandemic had a large impact on our business. Having said that, Goyla Butter Chicken from the start was always focused on deliveries and takeaway. So in that sense, our loss of revenue and a loss of business was slightly lesser than an average restaurant. But a lot of my friends, restaurateurs who are in this industry have gone through an extremely tough time. The pandemic has taken its toll on our industry, and I think it has set us back by at least a couple of years.
Goyla found his calling early, winning a televised cooking competition at the age of 25, which led him to host a travel program showcasing regional Indian cuisine. His profile exploded in 2018 when he was invited by former MasterChef Australia judge George Kalambaris to be a guest on the hit show, with contestants asked to recreate his signature dish.
Graduation is an exciting moment for all schoolgoers, but the occasion turns more joyful if it ends with a celebration like Scarlet Sales Festival, which is held in St. Petersburg in Russia at the end of the school year. The annual event is part of the famous White Nights Festival, traditionally held in summer, with spectacular fireworks, numerous music concerts, and a massive water show. Normally, thousands of domestic and foreign tourists flock to the city to watch the colorful event. But this year, the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of the attendees. The festival began in the 1960s when several Russian schools united to celebrate the end of the academic year. That is in connection with the symbolism of the popular 1922 children's book, Scarlet Sails, by Alexander Grin. Indonesia is dealing with a surge in coronavirus infections, but that has not stopped the people from observing the Yatnya Kasada Festival. Thousands of people braved the climb to the summit of Mount Bromo in eastern Java province to observe the ancient ritual. They made offerings ranging from fruits and crops to livestock by throwing the items to the pit of an active volcano. They believe the practice brings blessings and plenitude and helps them express gratitude for what they have. This year's festival was overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, with participants required to adhere to strict health protocols. China's space agency has released videos of its first Mars rover as it's exploring the red planet's surface. The rover is named Zhurong. It's now investigating a vast plane known as Utopia Planitia on Mars's northern hemisphere. The rover successfully landed on Mars in mid-May. It is studying the red planet's surface rocks and atmosphere. It also looks for signs of life, including any subsurface water or ice. The solar-powered Chinese robot weighs around 240 kilograms and has 6 wheels. China is the second country after the U.S. to operate a rover on Mars. A university in the Venezuelan capital Caracas has turned its roof into a garden and uses sustainable energy to light up its classes. The roof of Andres Bello Catholic University is covered with plants and 30 solar panels. The panels, along with a wind turbine, produce the 7,400 watts of electricity to illuminate that area and light two rooms in the building. The roof is now functioning as a self-sufficient and environmentally friendly open-air classroom. The proposal for the project was put forward by two students. The aim is to educate people about renewable energy and the threat of climate change.
A small New Hampshire town has been hit by a series of car break-ins over the last few weeks. People were shocked when they finally discovered the mischievous criminal. A large black bear has been identified as the bandit wreaking havoc in the town of Thornton. The naughty mammal was caught on camera as it got on its two hind legs and skillfully opened the door of a car. Police say the bear was most likely rummaging for food. Authorities have asked people to remove food from their cars to avoid enticing the troublesome animal. A Jordanian woman is receiving high demands for the soap she produces. Why? Because she uses an unusual ingredient. Lara Altiti makes soap out of camel milk. She tours different cities in Jordan to find the best camel farms for her business. Titi uses camel milk as the major ingredient for the soap she produces. That's because she says it has rich benefits and contains more vitamins than cow milks.
The first stage includes weighing the soap, and I include different kinds of oil to preserve the quality of the soap and its therapeutic benefit. We need to have high foam and tough consistency, and we don't want it to be rancid. We place high importance on the therapeutic material that we add during the production process.
Titi started her soap line at home using a manual process and then expanded it to an independent workshop. Her soap line has now become very popular in Jordan. Titi produces more than 4,000 soap bars a month. She sells them both to domestic and international customers.
If you're a car lover, this story is for you. Over 300 classic vehicles have taken part in a retro rally across Estonia. The 1,000-kilometer rally kicked off in the town of Perde. It drew participants from Latvia and Finland. Their motto is Straight Ahead to the Past. The vintage cars participated in the event are mostly produced between 1930 and 1980. Experts say all the vehicles are in good condition. However, they doubt if all the vehicles can make it to the end of the five-day rally.
The German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out, and we want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter. It will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games. Walking around the city without shoes can be delightful. If you're interested in the experience, visit the Russian capital. A 3.5-kilometer long barefoot trail has recently opened in Moscow's Elk Island Park. It's made of various materials such as pine bark, beach pebbles, and clay. Taking around 40 minutes to complete, the path attracts hundreds of visitors every day. However, some people find it difficult to walk without shoes, calling the path a torture trail. A zoo in Turkey has welcomed a baby elephant from an endangered species. The birth of a female calf at Izmir Wildlife Park has caused excitement in keepers and visitors. The calf, yet to be named, is the third offspring of parents from Asian species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies the Asian elephant as endangered due to their rapid decline in the wild. The Asian elephants are primarily threatened by poaching, fragmentation, and loss and degradation of habitat. Currently, around 20 to 40,000 Asian elephants are living across the world, five of which inhabiting Turkey's Izmir Zoo.
A Palestinian artist has come up with the idea of making children feel happy after the recent Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip left many people dead. Amna Sami is a young Palestinian artist who has gathered Palestinian kids in the city of Beit Lahia, north of Gaza. That's where houses were destroyed by Israeli airstrikes and bombings during the recent aggression on the territory. Sami draws the Palestinian flag as well as the map of Palestine on children's cheeks as patriotic symbols. She says she does that to say that these people in the midst of destruction will become strong again. Sami says by painting on kids' faces, she wants to send a message to the world.
I'm sending a message to the world that our children should live like other children in the world, away from danger and destruction. It is their right in life to live as children in a safe place, a place that gives them something to live a normal life.
Palestinian kids say they feel happy when Sami paints their faces. The Israeli regime launched this devastating onslaught on Gaza in early May. At least 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed during the 11-day war. A Turkish band has found musical inspiration in a most unlikely place, a local landfill. Here's more. Members of Funk Istanbul have assembled instruments from the dump in a junkyard in Istanbul. They used their ingenious new tools to play Turkish folk music. The band aims to raise awareness about recycling. Turkey is one of the biggest producers of municipal waste globally. The country has a low recycling rate. Only 12% of waste is repurposed there.
IRIB English Radio.